Hello again, you're listening to The Business. You can contact us by text to 51551, by phone to 1850715150, email thebusiness@rte.ie or tweet to @thebusinessrte. It's been 9 years since the book Freakonomics took the world by storm, selling more than 7 million copies in the period since then. The book used economics to explain the motivations of everyday life and everything from how your child's name would impact on its future to the pay scale of drug dealers. The authors have just published a new book, Think Like a Freak, and we're joined by one of them now, Stephen Levitt. Stephen, before we go to Think Like a Freak, let's go back to the first book. One of the most controversial and famous examples you used in that book was a correlation between the legalization of abortion in the 1970s in the United States and crime rates in the 1990s. What did you say about that?
Yeah, we sure made a lot of enemies with that hypothesis. So it's a pretty simple story. The idea is that children who are unwanted by their parents tend to be at high risk for bad life outcomes, such as turning into criminals. Basically, if your mother doesn't love you, life can be difficult. And it's widely agreed that that's true. And it's also widely agreed that after we legalized abortion in the United States, the number of unwanted children fell dramatically. For instance, the number of children that were put up for adoption fell by about 3/4 after abortion was legalized in the early 1970s. And so it's a very simple theory. Unwanted children are a risk for crime. Legalized abortion reduced the number of unwanted children. Therefore, it seems legalized abortion should reduce crime. Admittedly, it's a shocking and to many people a disturbing story. But the data really seem to support it. And we go through reams and reams of data from the U.S., and it looks like about a third of the incredibly miraculous crime decline that we saw in the United States in the 1990s seems to be linked to legalization of abortion in the 70s. Now, the important thing is that people hear that and they think that I'm jumping to some conclusion like legalization of abortion was a good thing or the right thing, which it really isn't the point at all. What we're trying to understand is why did crime go down? And one of the things we advocate in the new book, Think Like a Freak, is putting away your moral compass when you try to figure out the answer to the questions. But then, of course, when you think about what the right policies are, then you want to, of course, consider morality and ethics in coming to the right decisions.
So what kind of stories are in the new book? I know there's one colorful one about penalty kicks in soccer and the best, statistically, the best place to put the ball.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So along with the French economist Pierre-André Chiappori, we studied a bunch of data from penalty kicks in the Premier League in the UK and also from some of the continental leagues. And we tallied up over many years the penalty kicks and the outcomes. And the obvious strategies, if you're a kicker, the best place to put it, the easiest place to put it, if you're a right-footed kicker, is to put it in the upper left, that kicking, it's a strong side for the right-footed kicker. Of course, the goalie knows that, so the goalies, it turns out, are more likely to jump to the to their right to try to block the shot. And so in equilibrium, it turns out that kicking right and kicking left, as you might expect, yield about the same success rate. But what's really interesting in the data is there's a third strategy altogether, which leads to success about 7 percentage points more often than kicking right or left, and that's just kicking the ball right down the middle. Okay? And so it's surprising that these wouldn't equilibrate. You would say, you know, if kicking it down the middle is so good, why do so few kicks go down the middle? Because, in fact, a very small share of the kicks are sent down the middle. And one of the explanations we think, which is probably right, is that the actual utility function, the actual cost, if you imagine a kicker in the World Cup, the embarrassment that comes with a miss in the middle is actually so much greater than the embarrassment that comes with a kick to the right or the left, so that even if there's a higher chance of scoring, we think that from a selfish perspective, it may make sense for one of these elite players to say, look, if I kick it to my strong side and the goalie makes a heroic save, look, I didn't score, but at least I'm not a goat. But if I kick it down the middle and it hits him in the stomach because he decided not to move this time, I'm going to have to relocate my family to another country to avoid, you
exactly.
know.
Well, I'm not, that's a common theme throughout the book. What you've touched on there is this idea of a fear of going against the consensus and the herd mentality and people's fear of the consequences of that. How can we apply these insights from these particular statistical facts into our daily lives?
Well, that's really what we're trying to get at in the book. And we, you know, I don't know what problems your listeners have, and I bet they run the gamut from everything you could imagine, little things, big things, personal things, work things. And so we have, you know, we tried to distill our way of thinking into some sort of rules of thumb that people could apply. So one of the first points we make in the book is that that there's a tremendous value and yet a tremendous reluctance for people to say, I don't know. I mean, you know, for instance, especially if you think about politics or in work environments, there's so much hesitancy to admit ignorance. And for example, we went through all of the presidential elections for the last 40 years in the United States, and we looked at the transcripts and we tried to find how many times one of the candidates, when asked some of the very difficult questions are asked, responded by saying, I don't know. It turns out not once has a candidate in a debate, a presidential debate in the United States, ever admitted weakness if they didn't know the answer to a question.
That's because they always know, Stephen. They have all
absolutely.
The answers.
You know, our American politicians are can't be faulted. They have perfection. But the key is, look, we've been trained, we've been told, oh, you got to fake it, you got to pretend like you know what you're doing. And that may be a good strategy in the long run. But one thing we've learned is that if you ever want to improve, if you ever want to get to the truth, you have to admit you don't know the answer. Otherwise, you can't make the investment to get the feedback to actually try to find out the answers. And so we think there's just a tremendous value, and it really governs our own life, of being honest with yourself and realistic. I mean, you don't know the answer. Doesn't seem to us to be such a sin to say, I don't know the answer, but let me try to figure it out.
One of the things that strikes me about your approach is that you seem to rely on statistics and data as if it can tell the whole story. So, for example, in the penalty shootout, what if people actually aim to kick it to the left or right and it ends up accidentally going down the middle? The truth is that statistics and data always only give us part of the of human experience and can only inform part of making decisions.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think of our approach as being one piece of an intricate puzzle that ends up informing the world. And so, for instance, sometimes people say to me, well, wouldn't the world be a great place if the economists ran the world? And I say, no, probably not, because economists are missing some important pieces of the way they think of the world that could lead things to be a complete disaster. So I'm with you 100%, but I don't think you want to take that attitude to the extreme. I mean, some people take what you just said and they say, therefore, I don't want to consider data at all and coming to my conclusions. And I want to dismiss data and statistics even when they support the other side, or especially when they support the other side. And I think that's, you know, I'm firmly against that view as well. I think, you know, in my own life, I often can see examples where my beliefs are changed once I have a chance to look at the data and I see what it says. And usually, I think in those cases, they've been moved in the right direction. And so I'm a believer in data. Everyone else doesn't have to be a believer in data, but I certainly think we'll go to my grave believing in data.
Well, one of the things when in your own personal life, do you always rely on the data to inform your decisions? And what do your family think of that?
Sometimes I get a little bit annoyed when I want to rely on the data. But let me be clear. I actually think there are a whole, every day we face, I don't know, 100 decisions, 500 decisions. And if you tried to rely on the data and to think hard about every problem you had to make, every problem you had to answer, look, you wouldn't get out the door in the morning. You know, you wouldn't be able to decide what to wear. You wouldn't be able to decide what to eat for breakfast. So much of what we do using rules of thumbs and it's rote. And I think that's totally fine. And really, when we talk about using data, it's in the very select cases where you have some problem and where you want that problem solved. And so, you know, in business settings, it's easy to think about, because very often a business will have a problem and no one has the answer and you have to figure out ways to do it. And your personal life, you know, maybe it has to do with, you know, you have a kid and you want to incentivize your kid to study harder, or maybe your wife has a habit that drives you crazy and you want to figure out how to persuade her to do something that she doesn't naturally want to do, or maybe it's about bargaining, about negotiation in the family. And I think when you have those occasional problems that are thorny, you don't see obvious solutions, that's when I'd say, hey, go to our essentially what I'd call almost like a checklist in our book. Can that possibly give me a clever solution to the problem I have here? And my answer won't always be yes, but I think sometimes it might actually turn out to be helpful.
Stephen Levitt, author of Think Like a Freak, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much.